This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we take a look at the rash of conservative laws sweeping the country as different states try to limit abortion.
It's not a given that they're going to be successful. Let's hear what's being done to organize against them.
We take a look at the United States' increasingly harsh policies toward the island nation of Cuba.
They haven't been successful in rolling back the 60-year-old Cuban Revolution, but they're escalating their efforts.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. Halfway through 2019, nine states have already passed bills to limit abortion. Louisiana recently passed a ban on the medical procedure after a fetal heartbeat is detected. That makes it the ninth state in 2019 to pass abortion restrictions that could challenge the constitutional right established in Roe v. Wade. Alabama legislators also recently voted to ban abortions in nearly all cases. Other measures like Louisiana's have limited the procedure to earlier in pregnancy, typically around 6 weeks. Georgia, Kentucky, Louisiana, Missouri, Mississippi, and Ohio stopped short of outright bans. They too have passed so-called heartbeat bills that effectively prohibit abortions after 6 to 8 weeks of pregnancy. Utah and Arkansas voted to limit the procedure to the middle of the second trimester. Most other states follow the standards set by the Supreme Court's 1972 Roe decision, which says abortion is legal until the fetus reaches viability. That's usually at 24 to 28 weeks. The latest bans aren't yet in effect. Kentucky's was blocked by a judge, for example, and all bans are expected to face protracted court battles. What does all this mean? More states are considering and will likely pass measures similar to that in Louisiana in an effort to challenge Roe v. Wade. Today, we are joined by attorney Elizabeth Smith from the Center for Reproductive Rights. Elizabeth is their chief counsel for state policy. Before that, she was legislative director at the ACLU of Washington, where she was their legislative director. Elizabeth, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much. It's nice to be here with you.
Over the past several years, Republican legislators have successfully pushed bills to restrict abortion by imposing mandatory waiting periods for patients or hospital admitting privileges for doctors. How pervasive was that kind of restriction in the past decade or two?
So hospital admitting privileges is... Laws requiring hospital admitting privileges for providers of abortion care have been introduced and enacted in a number of states. And to date, those laws are blocked in states including Texas, Wisconsin, Mississippi, Oklahoma, and they are in effect at others. And they are in effect currently in states like Missouri, North Dakota, and Utah, and others. So hospital admitting privileges are a complicated subject. There is an argument that they help increase patient safety, but what we know and what the Supreme Court determined in Whole Women's Health in 2016 is that hospital admitting privileges are given by hospitals for a number of business reasons unrelated to patient safety. And so, in fact, they don't add to patient safety, and that is why the Supreme Court found Texas's hospital admitting privileges law unconstitutional in 2016.
And I imagine that the waiting periods for patients puts an additional burden in terms of the logistics of getting an abortion.
Absolutely. So when patients have to visit a clinic more than once, because sometimes the waiting period requires an appointment at the beginning of the waiting period and then a second appointment for abortion care, you can imagine all of the things that that would lead someone to have to figure out: time off of work, childcare, transportation, etc. And so that absolutely places another hurdle that patients have to jump over in order to get the care that they want.
Now, bringing us a little more to where we are, were you and others at the Center for Reproductive Rights prepared for the changes that we've been seeing recently in different states?
In terms of the number of restrictive laws that have been passed?
Yes.
Yes. So we at the Center and our national and state partners have seen states enact restrictive laws. About 400 of them have been enacted since 2010. So we knew that this legislative session, states that are hostile to abortion rights would likely feel even more empowered with changes on the Supreme Court to pass additional restrictive laws. So we were prepared, and yes, we have seen even more. The restrictions that have been passed this session are really even more dramatic than many that we've seen in the past.
Elizabeth, voter suppression and gerrymandering have allowed for states, particularly the ones that have passed these abortion restrictive laws, have empowered these legislators. Can you talk about the impact of that?
Voting rights is absolutely not my area of expertise, but I think we can see trends. States that have passed laws, restricting access to abortion tend to also be states that are interested in putting additional hurdles in front of people wishing to vote. So I think if the elections had gone differently in Georgia, for example, I doubt that if Stacey Abrams had been the governor of Georgia, she would have signed the six-week ban that Governor Kemp signed.
How popular are abortion restrictions? I mean, people, we've had abortion rights for so many decades. You would think that the majority of Americans support that.
The majority of Americans do support abortion rights. Polls that ask people whether they support Roe v. Wade continuing to stay the law of the land show that about 70% of Americans agree that they want Roe v. Wade to remain in place. The question about people's opinion around abortion becomes complicated when people are asked to weigh in on various kinds of restrictions. Again, the restrictions that we've been talking about have been put in place with the idea that they are helpful or good for women's health. And so when you ask people whether they agree with a restriction that they have heard over and over again is good for women's health, I often wonder if they, you know, are giving their opinion, yes or no, with kind of a full understanding that these laws, in fact, aren't good for women's health, and actually just put another barrier in between a pregnant person and the care that they seek.
Elizabeth, many abortion rights advocates say that limiting the procedure to before 6 weeks of pregnancy is in effect a complete ban. Many women don't even know they're pregnant till that point. What is the relevance of 6 weeks? And do you have any statistics about the number of women who might miss that deadline?
So I was actually just with members of the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecology on Friday, and we were talking about six-week bans. And the doctors who were presenting talked at length about the fact that in medicine, the marker, a six-week marker, or when a fetal heartbeat can be seen on an ultrasound, really is not a medical marker. It doesn't suggest, for instance, that the pregnancy is viable or that any real sort of moment in time has been reached. And so the other thing that these physicians talked about is that in medicine, when you say 6 weeks, what that means is 6 weeks since the last menstrual period. So in effect, that person, while the pregnancy is dated to 6 weeks, that's really only potentially 2 weeks after a missed period, and that's with the idea that, you know, someone has a regular period which not everyone does. So again, this is not a moment in time that means anything medically. 6 weeks is really 2 weeks after a missed period. And again, this really is a point in which many women do not know that they are pregnant yet. And so the idea that people would be able to get the care that they need and want prior to the fetal heartbeat being seen on a monitor at around 6 weeks is really just a fallacy.
How active are physicians in trying to get the word out about some misconceptions in these laws? For example, changing the Roe standard of when a fetus is viable to a random number like 6 weeks. Is there an active group lobbying to educate people and legislators about this?
So I want to say one thing before I get to answering the question. So viability is, according to Supreme Court precedent, is a medical concept, not a legal concept. So it is a medical and not a legal standard. Viability in this country is still around 24 weeks. And so, yes, a lot of the physicians that I've spoken to, and these are, you know, OBGYNs, maternal fetal specialists, people who provide, you know, gynecological or obstetric care, and they have been very frustrated by the public conversation and the how evident it is to them that the medical concepts that they speak about are really poorly understood by the general public, and that opponents of abortion rights have sort of honed in on medical language and utilized it in public conversation and in legislative advocacy in a way that is not strictly accurate.
You know, the whole campaign is about killing babies. And what bothers me is that they talk about a fetal heartbeat, but really at 6 weeks, an embryo really doesn't have anything like a heart in the way we understand what a heart is.
That's absolutely right. And, you know, I've written down some statements that I've heard physicians make in terms of trying to accurately describe what is visible. And again, not audible, but what is visible on an ultrasound at around 6 weeks. And I've heard it described as a pulse in a tube that's pushing fluid back and forth and primitive electric activity that you can see. So again, not that you hear. And so I've heard physicians describe this moment in which, you know, electric pulsing or activity is visible, not as sort of a medical marker, but as something that makes patients who have a wanted pregnancy, who want to carry a child to term, it makes them happy to see that marker, but it again is not something that denotes, you know, a specific developmental stage.
Elizabeth, what are progressive legislators doing, if anything, to protect abortion rights in their states?
So I'll say two things. There are states this legislative session that have enacted really strong protective laws, both laws protective of abortion rights, but also laws that increase access to abortion care. And two that I would highlight are the Reproductive Health Act in New York that was enacted in January, and then Illinois, right at the close of their session, very recently, also enacted a Reproductive Health Act. So those are two states where there is now a statutory right to abortion, which will ensure that regardless of what happens federally, that abortion will remain a right in those states. In addition to those two great laws, there are legislators in other states doing passing a variety of other bills. The state of Maine, for instance, just passed a bill that will allow advanced practice clinicians to provide abortion care in Maine. And the state of Nevada just repealed some restrictions that were in law there that required, for instance, a provider to ask about the pregnant person's marital status prior to providing abortion care. So going forward in Nevada, those questions will no longer be asked.
For those who just joined us, we're speaking with attorney Elizabeth Smith from the Center for Reproductive Rights. Elizabeth is their chief counsel for state policy. Elizabeth, do you think that women who can afford to do it will travel to other states that permit abortions?
So even prior to Roe v. Wade, there were still women in the United States who were accessing abortion care. But the women who were able to do that were women of means. And so going forward, in states where there's currently a lack of access, pregnant people who have means can travel and get that care elsewhere. If there was a new Supreme Court case that determined that states had greater leeway, for example, to prohibit access to abortion, there would still be people in those states who could travel and could access abortion care in states like New York or Illinois, where it will remain legal. But even today, abortion care is out of reach for people living in states with only a few clinics where it's very expensive and there are lots of barriers in place, like waiting periods, bias counseling, etc. So regardless of what happens with abortion legally, there are people who will still be able to access it, and depending on what happens, there will likely be more people than today who aren't able to access the abortion care that they want and need.
If we get a dire situation where the restrictions continue, do you think there will develop an underground market, a black market for abortions? And can you talk about what the problems are in that case?
So I think it's important to remember that all of this is hypothetical, but if states were allowed greater leeway to restrict access, we are not in the same situation that we were prior to Roe v. Wade being decided. And so the question of a legal abortion is not necessarily the same question as a safe abortion, because medication abortion is very, very safe. And so the question of how people in states where in the future, let's say, their desire to prohibit abortion becomes possible, people in those states would sometimes travel, and other times they would probably try to seek out medication abortion, even if in this future we're talking about that wasn't strictly legal. And so currently today, there are abortion funds in the majority of states, and those funds help people with travel expenses, with medical expenses, and help them access the care they need. Going forward, if people were forced to leave their state, abortion funds would still help people get to other places where they could legally access abortion care. Again, it becomes a lot more expensive to leave the state for care. So I think in this potential future, which again, you know, we don't know if the court would allow states this greater leeway to restrict access, but if they did, abortion funds would continue to help people, but at some point there is a finite amount of money, right? And medication abortion is very safe when people know how to take the pills and in what order. So while, yes, there will likely be people potentially trying to go kind of outside of their state laws in order to access care, I do want to leave your listeners with the idea that we are not talking about the situation of the 1960s or the early 1970s or prior to that.
Yeah, well, that's a tremendous relief to hear that. Talk more about medication abortions. Is that the answer? Is that the future? Couldn't those medications be outlawed too?
Medication abortion is absolutely, that development was really helpful for abortion care. In some states, medication abortion can be accessed through telemedicine. So a provider can speak to a patient through video conferencing or through the telephone or over the telephone, and then someone where the patient is can then, if the doctor prescribes medication abortion, can provide it to them. That's really, really helpful in terms of access to abortion, because that means that someone, you know, in a rural state who's far from the provider can use technology to talk to the provider, get their questions asked. The provider can do, you know, can ask the questions that they need to ask, and then care can be provided.
What if these reactionary legislatures outlaw this kind of medicine?
So at this point, there are states that outlaw telemedicine use for medication abortion, but medication abortion is legal in all states. There are states that put additional restrictions on it.
I have a rather naive question. Given the option of medication abortion, why would a woman not go to that as a first choice?
So medication abortion is safe during the first trimester. And so after, depending on the person and the pregnancy, after, you know, 10 weeks or so, then medication abortion would not be the first choice for providers. Providers would look to a procedure rather than the medication.
Speaking of procedures, what kind of legal penalties might abortion doctors face if the laws become stricter?
Well, even today, states that are passing additional restrictions on abortion care tend to create penalties for violating those laws that are both civil and criminal in nature. So today in state code, there are across the country, there are laws that say, for instance, abortion is legal in these instances. Anyone who provides abortion care outside of these instances could face civil penalties related to their license to practice medicine, or criminal penalties. In some states, those criminal penalties are misdemeanors. In others, in other states, they are felonies. So those criminal penalties are already in law related to current restrictions. And as we saw in the state of Alabama, when they passed their total ban on abortion earlier this spring, there are very high criminal penalties for providers who either, and again, this was not defined in the law, but who either attempt an abortion or provide abortion care for a pregnant person.
Attorney Elizabeth Smith, what kind of organizing to roll back these terrible laws is going on at the local and the regional and the national level?
We have seen a very coordinated campaign that is multifaceted to really try to attack and roll back abortion rights and access to abortion. And so there are national groups that provide model legislation. There are state legislatures that, you know, speak to each other. There are state legislators who, you know, gather at various annual conferences. And I think you see all of that especially starkly in a session like we are having now, where prior to 2019, there were only 2 6-week bans that were enacted in any state. And both of those laws, while enacted, were never enforced, and they are both permanently blocked. But then, in this session, you see, you know, one state start to move a 6-week ban, and then suddenly you see 6-week bans in a variety of other states. So I think you can clearly chart kind of the coordination and the organization of those who, you know, whose goal ultimately is to prohibit all access to abortion care.
My own hope is that because the Supreme Court, however reactionary it has become, doesn't want to get too far ahead or too far behind public opinion. My hope, and I hope it's not a fantasy, is that millions of people will descend on Washington, D.C., and the Supreme Court will think twice about going against what is obviously a popular democratic right.
Well, and I think we have to remember that, you know, Roe v. Wade has been the law of the land for almost 5 decades. The makeup of the Supreme Court has changed multiple times in over those years. And the court has continued at every opportunity that they have had, has continued to confirm and reconfirm the central holding of Roe v. Wade. In addition to that, you know, I think it is obvious that states passing these restrictions feel emboldened in this moment in time because of recent changes to the court. But again, both new justices in their confirmation hearings confirmed that they would adhere to precedent. And Roe v. Wade is clearly precedent.
In our few remaining minutes, Elizabeth, can you give us a nutshell view of what kind of things the Center for Reproductive Rights is working on?
Absolutely. So I direct our state advocacy and policy work, and so my team and I work with advocates and state legislators throughout the states to defend against new restrictive laws, and we work to support state advocates and state legislators to enact good supportive laws that either codify the right to abortion under state law or work to create additional access. In addition to that, my colleagues who do litigation for the center have a cert petition in front of the Supreme Court right now for our Louisiana admitting privileges case. And that the law that we have litigated in Louisiana is identical to HB 2, the admitting privileges law in Texas that the Supreme Court found unconstitutional in 2016. And so we have asked the Supreme Court for a summary reversal of the Fifth Circuit's ruling that Louisiana's law could stand, which was a reversal of the district court. And in addition to that, we are hard at work with our national partners and our state partners on litigation, on policy advocacy. Our federal team is working with members of Congress on the Women's Health Protection Act, which is a piece of federal legislation that would create a floor, and so that would, in essence, prohibit states from passing many of the restrictions that we've been talking about this morning.
And if you don't mind, on a personal note, how did you get involved in this kind of work?
My mother was a health educator at Planned Parenthood in Texas when I was a very young person, and so she talked to me about her work and took me to vigils and protests. And as a teenager, I was a member of the Planned Parenthood of South Central Texas. That affiliate has since renamed, but that's what it was called in the 90s. I was a member of their teen action group. And so with other teenagers in San Antonio, I spoke to our peers about basically sex ed, contraception, and just found it really, really rewarding.
A born activist, I see.
A second generation.
How can listeners learn more about the center's work?
On our website, we have information about the policy work that we do and about all of our litigation. And this fall, my team will be publishing a resource that I hope will be really helpful to your listeners and to many others. The resource is called What If Roe Fell? And it's a publication the center has published at various times since the early 2000s. The new version that's coming out will include all of the state laws that are being enacted in 2019, and it will answer the question, if the Supreme Court was to limit or reverse Roe v. Wade, what would be the state of abortion law in every state and all U.S. territories?
Well, that sounds like a must read for our audience. Yep. Elizabeth, it's been really a pleasure to chat with you today, and we know how busy you are given current events.
Yeah, you have Absolutely. Our respect and solidarity, and we hope to get you back to announce some victories.
Right.
Thank you so much. It was lovely to talk to both of you.
Thank you, Elizabeth Smith.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.
July 26, 2019, marks the 60th anniversary of the Cuban Revolution. On that date, revolutionary troops led by Fidel Castro and Che Guevara marched into Havana. The American-supported dictator Batista fled to the Dominican Republic. Other rich Cubans went to Miami. At that time, the wealth of Cuba, its vast, fertile sugar cane and tobacco fields, its oil refinery, its phone company, were all owned by U.S. corporations and a handful of wealthy Cubans. To obstruct the revolution, the U.S.-owned oil refinery stopped providing oil so that there was no gasoline in Cuba. In response, the Cuban revolutionaries nationalized the refinery, then the phone company, then the nickel mines, and then the vast land holdings. This willy-nilly was the beginning of the Cuban Revolution. The Cuban government offered to pay the owners for the nationalized property in the amount that the owners had listed them for tax purposes. The owners refused. They wouldn't take the money. Since then, the American government has waged economic warfare on Cuba. In an escalation of this warfare, last week we saw the instigation of the dormant Title III section of the anti-Cuban 1996 Helms-Burton Act. This law permits U.S. citizens to sue anyone, anywhere in the world, in an American court for using property legally expropriated by the Cuban government after the revolution. Expropriation of a foreign-owned property is legal under international law so long as the owners are compensated. In addition to the invocation of the Helms-Burton law, the U.S. government has ended people-to-people travel to Cuba and drastically reduced the amount of money Cuban Americans living in the U.S. can send back to their families on the island. Here to speak with us is Netfa Freeman. He is a policy analyst with the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, D.C., and an organizer in the International Committee for Peace, Justice, and Dignity.
Netfa Freeman, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
Could you please describe the latest attacks by the U.S. on the Cuban economy? And do you think it's opened up floodgates for litigation over the property confiscation 60 years ago?
Mm-hmm. So if we just stay to the economic attacks, then we'll have to talk about the first, not very first, obviously, because Cuba has been under attack by the United States for 60 years, for a long time. The initial thing was about a year ago, or not long after the Trump administration. I think it's relevant to creating some context, is this propaganda around what has been termed a sonic attack. And it was an alleging that some sort of sonic weapon or something was used against officials in the embassy in Cuba, the U.S. embassy in Havana. And so people might know that the normalization of relations included the opening, reopening of the embassies in the respective countries. And so in Havana, they claimed that there was this sonic attack, and it seemed to be a pretext to evacuate all of the officials there. And also a sort of de facto travel warning. The United States government has been pretty uncooperative in providing any kind of information to anyone about it, particularly the Cuban government that was trying to get down to the bottom of it because they considered it a serious thing for in terms of the safety, being able to provide for the safety of diplomats in the country. But at the same time, other people have not been able to press and media have not been able to deal with it. Now, right before, and I was just in Cuba the end of April and into May, we traveled to Cuba on the 14th May Day Brigade. Just before we went, they announced the implementation of Title III, which is a provision of the Helms-Burton Act that was established to codify the embargo. A lot of us say blockade instead of embargo because of the pervasiveness and multifaceted nature of the policies, U.S. policies against Cuba, so we talk about it as a blockade of Cuba. And that act codified as legislation the U.S. policy toward Cuba, the multifaceted and protracted war-type policies against the country that were established back in the 60s but were not codified until the 1990s. And that includes all kind of travel restrictions, making it necessary to get a license to travel from the Office of Foreign Assets Control, it was just part of the Treasury Department, that made it illegal to trade with Cuba, to have certain trade with Cuba, and it also provided money through agencies like the U.S. Agency for International Development to fund what they call a Cuba program, a Cuban democracy program or something like that, and to fund organizations, particularly organizations that are Cuban-American or Cubans on the ground, not just fund, but also provide what is known, what they call, as in the name, technical assistance, or advising them on how to establish quote-unquote democracy, pretty much a regime change project.
Have the floodgates been opened for litigation over property that was confiscated 60 years ago?
Title III of the Helms-Burton Act says that U.S. citizens can bring lawsuits against anyone internationally who has been said to be using property in Cuba that was nationalized, which is what you referred to. So the first lawsuit was leveled right after they announced this, right after they announced implementing Title III, because all the previous administrations had been waiving that aspect of the Helms-Burton Act, the implementation or the enforcement of Title III. And then the Trump administration, through Bolton and all them, announced them actually going to start enforcing it. And this was right before we went in April. And as soon as they announced it, well, they said they were going to do it, and then they actually implemented it in, I think it was in May, right, while we were there. And then as soon as they did it, there was a company called Havana Docks or something, and it's a person whose family owned a dock in Cuba, a shipping port. They brought up legislation, a lawsuit against a cruise ship company that's been taking cruises to Cuba and been using the dock for cruises. There's also one other, it wasn't a floodgate, but the Trump administration has been predicting like some sort of floodgate type of response, but it hasn't been that so far, but they suspect and they actually probably hope that there will be. And so there's right now I know of two lawsuits, and that one that I mentioned, and then there was another one that I'm blinking on that came shortly after that, and that was the first one was like the day after, I think May 2nd or something like that, that they actually filed for the company to sue this cruise ship company. And then your other question was about the other effects on the economy. So one of the things that the Trump administration opened up was people-to-people travel, then to allow people to travel under certain, expanding the types of licenses people could get, and that would be through educational exchanges and things like that. And then the Trump administration prohibited that as part of the new measures, also prohibiting tourist travel through cruise ships, so not disallowing cruise ships to dock there or else be fined. And so those are the things that they've stopped. And this will have a serious effect. A lot of people, there was a large spike in travel to Cuba after the Obama administration announced and normalized relations and also loosened up trade and travel by executive orders. So there was a large spike in people going to Cuba, particularly through vacations and things like this. And then because of this, Cuba has been making loosening up their abilities for people on the island to open up more private entrepreneurial ventures like hotels and small hotels like B&Bs and also restaurants and things like that. A lot of people put a lot of investment, family investment and savings and things and these kind of things. These things will be sorely affected by this new restriction, so it's going to have an incredible impact on the economy that's yet to be seen.
Netfa, I heard that there's a rationing of basic food stocks. Do you have any updates on that?
Cuba's always had some form of rationing of basic food stocks because the blockade has persisted. It's never been, and then people also think that Obama administration lifted the blockade, but the blockade persisted, so there still have been restrictions on certain types of trade. Because of what has been happening, because of the Trump administration rolling back things, Cuba has had to deal with certain rationing of food stocks in order to make sure it's more equitably distributed and that people who aren't more economically advantaged, because it's not, you know, everybody, some people have more economic advantage than others, aren't able to hoard things away from other people, and that people who are less advantaged still have access to basic food. So there has been that, and it sounds to people like it's some sort, I don't know, in this country, we kind of are orientated in such a way that when we hear about things like that, it sounds dictatorial or controlling, but in fact, these things are necessary for countries who really, like a small country like Cuba, that's an island, who really is at a lot of the mercy of the international global economy, the world economy, and then also has to make sure people's basic fundamental human needs are met, and that's their socialist project, that's their mission. Here, you can have people just starving to death with all kinds of opulence and wealth going on around them. And so I think it's important for people to know that this is a rational and humane way of approaching it, and actually is symbolic of socialist principles, which to make people more important than profit.
So can Americans still travel to Cuba? I know that you said that cruise ships can no longer take people there, but if one of our listeners wanted to go to Cuba, is it still possible to do that?
Yeah, it's still possible. There's 12 categories in which people can go to Cuba. Now, it won't be under tourism type of thing. That has effectively been ended, and that was what they were trying to end, one of the things they were trying to end. Also, they were trying to end the people-to-people exchanges that have actually done a lot to expose people to what really is going on in Cuba in terms of the propaganda. There's been a big media assault, which I didn't mention, is also part of the blockade. It's part of the Helms-Burton Act. It provides money and funding and things for how to propagandize against Cuba. And it didn't start with the Helms-Burton Act. It goes all the way back. But there's still 12 approved categories for people to go to Cuba. I mean, if people are Cuban and have family there, there's family visits that are still allowed. And if you're going on official business of the U.S. government or some foreign government, some other government, there's certain intergovernmental organizations and educational travel still allowed. You can go as a journalist still. Now, all of these you have to still apply and be approved for with the Treasury Department. Professional research and professional meetings, religious activities and public performances, those kind of things. If you're a performer and you could want to go there and perform, and or to do clinics or workshops or athletic things and competitions, those type of things are still there. Humanitarian projects and support for the Cuban people. These two categories, I think that people should be wary of. Of course, I'm not against or dissuading people from being able to support any people with any kind of thing and or have any type of humanitarian projects, obviously. But for the U.S., they have also been a means of destabilizing countries in a way that's hidden, a more covert way of destabilizing countries. And in the past, people have even talked about, we're talking about back in the early 2000s, we had the National Librarian Association or something like that, where they were going to Cuba and then had people from the government turn their trip into more of a subversion thing. In other words, they're going to Cuba to study the library system there and figure out how the libraries work. Well, one of the proxy type formations that the U.S. government was funding in Cuba were called quote unquote independent libraries, and the notion, the premise, or the implication being that Cubans don't have freedom of information and their information is controlled and they don't have libraries and the libraries they have are controlled by the government. And so if they have these independent libraries who are courageous Cubans trying to make sure information is provided, but of course these are people who are being used by the U.S. government and being provided with the information the U.S. government thinks or wants to put out to the people, and they found in the librarians, and when they were going on their mission, their exchange with other librarians to understand the system and support the system, they were told, or it was kind of signaled to them, that they needed to come back with certain types of findings, and then they needed to make sure they visit the independent librarians. So they went, and they did visit these independent librarians to come to find out these are people who were in their homes with these little small bookshelves of things that no one really knew, no Cubans really knew that they were there. They were doing this as a means to, and quote, there was an article that was called, and I had to see if it's still online, it was called For Services Rendered, and this was a librarian who went there who interviewed some of these independent librarians, and they called it by Services Rendered because that was the so-called librarian who doesn't have any kind of gift. be approved to be like certified to be a librarian. People go to school for a librarian, and so they found that these people didn't have any of these type of credentials, and they were pretty much people harboring information propaganda of the U.S., and that they were doing so for quote-unquote services rendered, and that was the term that this person used with this librarian who were there. So when instead of finding out what the U.S. government wanted them to find out, they found out also that there were people that the U.S. government was supporting in Cuba to kind of malign and destabilize its own country.
Netfa, how is it that the U.S. government cannot allow freedom of travel to Cuba? I mean, it just strikes me that the American freedom to travel is like freedom of the press or freedom of speech or freedom of assembly. You should be able to go somewhere and find out what you want to find out. What is the legal rationale for the U.S. government not allowing people like us to go see what we want to see?
Right, and it is the only country where people have to get a license to go. Well, I think right now in Cuba, it's not only the only country where Cuba people have, the U.S. people have to have a license to go there to travel to get permission, but it's the license to go is issued through the office, the Treasury Department. And so the way that they can do this is because in like 1917 or so, they established what was called the Trading with the Enemy Act, which authorized the president powers to oversee, to restrict different trade between the United States and countries that it deemed its enemy in times of war. Now, they expanded it later to be in times of peace as well, but it's defined as trading with the enemy, so any transactions, even like a plane ticket there or anything like that, is deemed a transaction that would be considered trading with the enemy. And Cuba right now, there have been a number of countries on the list, but now Cuba right now is the only country that falls under the category right now as an enemy, as being restricted by the Trading with the Enemy Act.
John Bolton, Trump's newly appointed national security advisor, has said that Cuba, along with Venezuela and Nicaragua, is part of what he calls a troika of tyranny, and that it undermines the stability of the region. What are your thoughts on that?
My thoughts on that is the most laughable. It would be funny if it wasn't so tragic in terms of it being how they rationalize what they're doing. So the United States is a very destabilizing entity everywhere in the world that it goes. And so for them to say that is ridiculous. And now what they probably don't like is the fact that Cuba, Venezuela, and Nicaragua have a solidarity, that they work with each other, that they probably assert their own interests on the global stage when it comes to the United Nations and things like that. They cooperate when it comes to health care officials and Venezuela giving oil to Cuba. Those type of things are not desirable for people who have that same colonial mentality, who openly talk about the Monroe Doctrine is not dead, and this is what drives their foreign policy when it comes to Latin America. These are colonialist, white supremacist, capitalist types of thinking. When you think you have the jurisdiction to talk about a Monroe Doctrine and this being your quote unquote, which is what the Monroe Doctrine was your backyard, so to speak, sovereign countries that are part of the United Nations that have the ability to govern their own, and they think they have jurisdiction of it. Now they're doing nothing. Cuba serves no threat. If anything, when this level of cooperation is a stabilizing effect, not a destabilizing effect. So when they're talking about supporting right-wing extremist governments like in Bolsonaro in Brazil and destabilizing. Honduras is seeing 10 years as really destabilized after 10 years of a government that was imposed by the United States after they made sure they couldn't recognize their democratically elected government in Honduras. So right now they're experiencing all kind of repression and privatization and extreme poverty and these kind of things, and their resistance is meeting repression, and the U.S. government is not saying anything about those kind of things. Talking about bringing NATO into this sphere with Brazil and Colombia. So if anything, as the United States, it's the destabilizing effect.
Well, let me continue on with this National Security Advisor John Bolton's advice to Trump. Bolton said that the companies that are doing business in Cuba were, quote, abetting this dictatorship by trafficking in confiscated property. Do you regard Cuba as a dictatorship?
they bandy that term around, dictatorship, determines how you define it. If, in fact, a class of people, like the workers of a country, can be what certain classic Marxists refer to as have a dictatorship of the proletariat, then I would think Cuba comes to the closest to that. That meaning, that would mean that people who are working, people who are producing, who the working class of the people are a driving force for the policies of the government in that country, then in that sense it might be. But it's not a dictatorship in terms of one person or a select few determining the policies and driving force in the politics of that government. In fact, it's more democratic than the United States. It has like 90-some percent, no less than, has never enjoyed less than 80-some percent of participation in their electoral processes. And that's already since they started having elections in the 70s. And so now in the United States, there's less than 50% of the people participate in the process. And then of those, there's a registered voters. And less than them, like only about 50%. It spiked over 50% when Obama got elected. And so now there's so many few people that even participate in the process here. And then in Cuba, if you're a Cuban, you're automatically eligible to vote at 16 years old. Cubans have the right to national referendums. United States doesn't have the right. U.S. citizens don't have the right to national referendums. In fact, only some states have that right. And so they can actually set and do more than vote for elected officials and things like that. In Cuba, they can vote for policy and vote for things. They voted for several new provisions in their constitution just recently. A long time ago, they've actually approved and reconfirmed on a referendum to make socialism an inseparable part of their constitution, of their system, their economic system. These are the people voting for this. The president, the equivalent of the president of Cuba, has less power than the president of the United States has. They can't veto a decision made by the National Assembly, which would be the equivalent to a Congress. They don't have that power to do that. They can't appoint their ministers. Here the U.S. president appoints their cabinet members. In Cuba, they're also elected by the National Assembly. And there's representatives in the National Assembly that are not just around geographic areas, like here, and you have Congress people representing districts or senators representing districts. In Cuba, they not only have geographical areas, but sectors of society are represented in the National Assembly. The Cuban Federation of Women holds seats on the National Assembly. The Youth League has seats on the National Assembly. The Cuban Federation of Workers and these formations. So in any these means, these sectors of society have a voice in the policies legislations of their country that makes it far more democratic than the United States, in my opinion.
Nefta Freeman, we're coming to the end of our allotted time, but I just wanted to ask you one more question about the Helms-Burton Act. The act is formally titled the Cuban Liberty and Democratic Solidarity Act. With respect to the intent of the act, it requires the President of the United States to produce a plan for providing economic assistance to a transitional government in Cuba. So do we have a law that codifies counter-revolution in Cuba? At bottom, is this an American attempt to restore capitalism to Cuba?
I mean, the short answer is yes. And in fact, such a plan has been created. Like in 2003, the Bush administration created a commission for the assistance to a free Cuba, which talked about how to hasten Cuba's peaceful transition, quote unquote, Cuba's peaceful transition to representative democracy and free market economy. So they've never accepted the fact that Cuba and other countries have the right to self-determination and to have any kind of government they want. Here we're taught that it's not democratic if it's not multi-party. There's nothing more democratic about multi-party governments. In fact, in my opinion, it creates political artificial polarizations, and prevents people from having to struggle with each other over real concrete issues. That's what this is. It's about regime change, and the CIA confirmed that in declassified records that go date all the way back to the 1960s, 1959, actually, where they talk about manufacturing. They don't use the word manufacturing. They mean supporting or creating, fostering an internal opposition. They actually admit the Cuban government was a popular government, and that they had to do everything they could to create the opposition for it inside. They've supported all types of exiles and terrorism and things like that to undermine the country And so this, it's had a policy of overthrowing the Cuban government ever since the beginning, and then this legislation codifies it when it does things like, you know, providing money through USAIDs and through the National Endowment for Democracy to support illegal transmissions through the Radio Martí and all these type of things into the country, and gives money to people to commit treason against their own government.
Netva Freeman, we've come to the end of our time here, but before Heidi and I have to say goodbye to you, can you tell us how our listeners can learn more about the Institute for Policy Studies, and how do they keep up with your writing?
So the Institute for Policy Studies website is ips-dc.org. That's ips-dc.org. You can go to the page where it says who we are on there, and it has all of the people that do work for IPS that are, we have a number of projects. And then when I write things or appear in media, when any of us do at IPS, they try to update, we try to keep our bio pages updated with where you can see not just our writings, but when we appear in the media and stuff like that. And so, yeah, that's the best way to do it.
Well, thank you very much, Netva Freeman. Good to have you as a guest on Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.